This is Robin Collier, and welcome to Cultural Energy's show on youth, arts, activism, and the environment. Tonight, we hear an hour talk given by historian Jerry Padilla on Comancheros, or the relations between some Native American tribes and early settlers in New Mexico. This talk was given on April 25th for the Old Spanish Trail Association, part of a series every Saturday through May at 10:15 a.m. at the Taos Library. Our online listening pages are sponsored by TaosNet, the Taos News, La Jicarita News, and the Horsefly. Now, Lloyd Rivera introduces Jerry Padilla.
Bueno, I want to present to you Jerry A. Padilla, historian, prominent news reporter for the Taos News. He hails from the Las Vegas to Raton region, specifically Springer, and he lives here in Taos as well. Jerry?
Gracias, Lloyd. Thank you, Lloyd. Good morning, everybody. Buenos días. God, what a group. Rogues gallery here. Okay, well, again, I'm glad to be here and happy to come and share with you a little bit of this information that has to do with Taos, Moran, northern New Mexico connection to this Old Spanish Trail to California. Now, there was certain commodities, certain products from New Mexico and the Great Plains areas that were very much in demand all over the world. But New Mexico didn't have any seaports, didn't have any connection. The closest, you know, the Rio Grande, eventually a few thousand miles, you get to the ocean down the Gulf of Mexico, but there was a lot of demand for certain commodities. One of the main, most popular items that was going to Mexico, because it was considered a delicacy, were smoked bison tongues. I don't know if any of you have ever had a tongue sandwich or tongue stew. It's pretty good. It's delicious. It doesn't sound like it, but if you want to taste it, it's not bad. Well, New Mexican people had learned from their Native American neighbors how to hunt bison, their style, with the bows and arrows and the lances, because there weren't any weapons, there weren't any firearms. The few firearms that had existed and survived around here were broken down. Maybe there was a couple, two or three people in the whole territory that knew how to fix them, armeros, that, you know, gunsmiths. So any firearms that were here were in very old arc buses, and but these cibuleros and later, you know, these people that came to be known as Comancheros were skilled in the ways of their Native American neighbors, Pueblos, Apaches, Comanches, Utes, Navajos, the whole spectrum of the tribal experience in this part of the world, as it was then. Before 1786, there was a lot of Comanche raiding together with Apaches, Navajos, Utahs, the other, you know, nomadic tribal people surrounding the province here. Probably the strongest groups were Comanches and Apaches, and they were rivals. They sometimes in later years they became also together with the Kiowas and the Cheyennes became allies because they were fighting for their own survival. But to get back to the beginning of this, in 1786, the Spanish viceroy, they had a discussion, well, prior to that, 1770s, decided that the raiding in New Mexico was so intense that this province was not going to continue. It was going to die off. Would be wiped out unless something was done. The main nemesis, the main raider against the Spanish people of New Mexico and the Pueblo Indians was Cuerno Verde, Comanche leader who had vowed eternal hatred for the Spanish when they killed his father in a battle at Ojo Caliente. And that, you know, he took up his father's lance and the headdress with the green horns. And he developed his own persona and use the fear and superstition of the Spanish people, the the idea of the devil is a major bad guy, his enemy, and he would play on this fear. Well, the viceroy and the council got together and said, we need to send someone to New Mexico that knows what he's doing, that knows how to deal diplomatically or in war, if necessary, with the enemies of the crown. They were considered, if you were accepted the Spanish authority, then you were subject to the crown. If you weren't, you were enemies. So they brought Don Juan Bautista de Anza from Sonora, who was the son of the Presidio commander there, and had just recently in 1776 helped establish Spanish communities in California, Monterrey, becoming the capital of Alta California. Baja California still has that same name. In those times, in the 1700s, the northern part of the present state of California, Alta California. Well, he had just solved the problem of the fear that the Russians and the English, Sir Francis Drake had landed a ship on the California coast to repair it, and the Spanish authority said, hey, these interlopers are coming in, the Russians are coming down the coast. They were in on the fur trade. The English and other countries were rivals with the Spanish and the Portuguese for the trade, to exploit the natural resources of the North American continent. So De Anza had a reputation for being the man of all seasons to solve problems, and wherever their things were desperate, they sent him, and he'd fix it. We got here to New Mexico, and the biggest problem at the time was that they could defend themselves against Apache raiders, or they could defend themselves against Comanche raiders or Navajo or Utah, whoever was, in the different regions, but they could not hold their own against all of them at the same time. They were overpowered. Even though they had the same tactics and they knew the same ways, and they most of the time they could, they could call truces and they'd have trade fairs, and then there was an unwritten rule: while you're at the trade fair, while you're in this camp here at Taos, a lot of time Taos and Pecos Pueblos, you were protected. Nobody was going to bother you. There was no fighting. Sometimes as soon as people visiting these fairs, as soon as they left after the truce was over, on their way, there's a pretty good looking palomino, let's take it. Because it was an honor for a young man amongst the Plains tribes to take horses and livestock and to raid and hunt. That was the sign of a man. If you were a good raider, you're a good hunter, you could provide well for your family, because that was the culture. It was rough times, it was harsh, and to compare it with today's standards is a mistake, because the world was not a very happy and nice place in the 1700s, here or anywhere. Now, a group of people in New Mexico, Hispanic and Pueblo Indians, learned after De Anza had the battle, he led the expedition into Colorado of Spanish soldiers, militia volunteers, and Pueblo and Ute and Jicarilla Apache allies. At that particular time, late 1700s, De Anza had formed an alliance with the Utes and Jicarillas. And they was trying to do the same with him with the Navajos. And a lot of the Pueblo people were, the soldiers, their fighting men, their warriors, were considered auxiliaries in mutual protection of each other's villages and communities. So De Anza had left from New Mexico. He took this expedition soon after he arrived to Colorado, traveling by night. Why? Because if you travel in the day, what do you get? Horse hooves, hundreds of horse hooves, and the few cows and sheep and things they took along to feed themselves. You got a lot of dust. And they could see you from a long way. So they traveled at night until they got to where Cuerno Verde's camp was at the base of the mountains, close to present Fountain, Colorado. And his scouts and his allies amongst the Utes and the Apaches checked it out. They came back and told him, he's not here. But we found out he's raiding Taos. He's on a raid in Taos. So Anza said, well, we'll just wait for him. He kept it secret. They positioned themselves. They waited. On his return, They didn't know that Anza had already taken some captives and had raided his camp and was going to use them as probably a bargaining chip. If Cuerno Verde decided not to fight, he could negotiate with him. Well, when Cuerno Verde found out that the Spaniards had snuck in to his camp and were waiting to fight him, he, you know, said, well, this is the enemy, and if they want to fight, we'll fight. And they had a battle, and he was killed. Then what happened? Anza, the diplomat that he was, said, we can fight each other until we're all gone, we're all dead, or we can try something else. You have the ability, you can come here, come to trade, come to be, help me become military allies, be my auxiliaries, help me fight Apaches. Apaches and Comanches were at the time traditional rivals. They had been rivals for a long time. And they raided each other, adopted each other's captives, and but this was one of the bargaining tools that Anza used. He said, help me and we'll help you. And in return, you're welcome to come here anytime. You can trade. So the tribal leaders of the Comanches and Namana decided, well, we'll try this. So they chose an individual, another leader by the name of Ecueracapa. To the Spanish, he was known as Ecueracapa, and his own name, Contatanacapara. It had to do with his own spirituality, his own rise to his spiritual and leading power. And he was sent. He came. And they negotiated at Pecos Pueblo and at Santa Fe. They agreed, we'll try. If you wanna allow us to come to trade, we'll be your allies. And they were during the ceremony, there was 12 other chiefs that came to accompany him representing the different bands. There were a very widespread, large group of plains people. And so the agreement was made that they would try to be peace and be have trade and be allies. This peace with the Comanches that came about after the raid at the Villalpando Hacienda and the raids at Tomé, where in each occasion at least 60-some women and children were taken captive because the men were all killed that were defending, that had been incorporated to the Comanche culture and heritage. And this was common practice with the tribal people. They raided each other, took captives. They would adopt them. They become part of the family of the person that was responsible. And the Spanish were doing the same thing. They were in their sporadic raiding back and forth. They would take the tribal captives and adopt them. They became the criados. So one of the consequences was that you had a lot of blood relatives between the New Mexicans and the Comanches and the other tribal groups, and where each area, you can find that information in this one book here, an excellent work by James F. Brooks on captives and cousins, explaining how this relationship of peaceful trading and cooperation came about in large part between the nomadic tribal peoples and the Hispanic and Pueblos because of this relationship of their cautivos. They were adopting each other's captives. After the Pueblo Revolt, after 1680, the Spanish policies relaxed in slavery raids and in the treatment of the native peoples. Things got better. They had learned their lesson when the Pueblo Revolt happened, when they had united, and they had been expelled for 12 years. And it wasn't just New Mexico. Northern Mexico, several native groups there also at the same time revolted and said, you know, we've had enough of the competition between the church and state officials to exploit the labor and the resources of our people. And, you know, enough is enough. They revolted, successfully drove out a European military power from this part of the world for 12 years. But getting back to the agreement, the peace, and then this resulted in the trade, a lot of trade. They would come to the Pueblos, to Taos, to Pecos, to different communities and hold those trade fairs couple times a year, or maybe just once a year. In some cases, this trade became crucial to keeping the peace between these two powers. The Hispanic people of New Mexico took this peace so serious that in the late 1790s, Iquitacapa was mortally injured. He was very badly injured in a battle with the Pawnees. And there was only one doctor here. This was already over into the early 1800s. There was only one doctor in Nuevo Mexico. It was a military surgeon, Cristobal Larrañaga, assigned to the Presidio at Santa Fe. But they valued the peace with the Comanches so much, they risked their only doctor in the territory with, you know, anywhere in the southwest area, to send him to try to save Iquitacapa's life. Well, the man didn't make it. He was too badly injured. It was a bad head injury. Well, they tried, but he died. So his successors continued this idea, peace with New Mexico and the benefit of the trade. Comanches were amongst the best raiders. They took over northern Mexico, in large part, and they raided, and that's because they were getting the best horses and mules from there. These people loved raising horses. They had the best horses in the continent because they knew how to breed them for their better qualities. And of course, they were Mustangs. But they mixed these Mustangs that they had together with the, you know, more pure-blooded line horses, the horses that were designed for more different purposes, military purposes, agricultural purposes, and the ones they raided and took from Mexico and the cattle. So they had, after a while, they hunted bison. They were used to being bison hunters and living off of the land. But in their raids, they had collected large numbers of cattle and horses, and they needed an outlet. And Nuevo Mexico was a natural consequence. They had friends here amongst the Spanish and the Pueblos who also would visit them. They needed more horses and cattle and stuff here. But I'm getting back to making a circle again. The main trade item from New Mexico over the Spanish Trail to Los Angeles was cattle hides, the leather. And they were getting, there wasn't a lot of cattle being raised here. Most of the cattle being raised here were being used for breeding purposes, the hacendados, the people that owned the land, that had the control over the land, they had some cattle, but the majority of the livestock here were sheep and goats. And this was very, very essential to this area. But all this surplus of cattle that the Comanches were raiding, taking in Texas and Mexico, the individuals in New Mexico became the brokers. Comancheros initially meant one who deals with Comanches and the other plains tribes, Kiowas, Cheyennes, Arapahos, the Utes. You know, different Utes were in mountains, but they had the plains-style culture. So did the Jicari Apaches, and groups of Apaches who had stayed in the plains so long, they had become affiliated with Kiowas and Comanches, and you know, the exchange between each other, taking captives and raising them. Well, they had a lot of cultural interaction and influence. But these individuals, these men who would go to trade, they would take the adventure to go out in the plains and take the products of the agriculture from the Rio Grande Valley, the calabazas, the chile, the beans. You know, these were nomadic people, and they needed the vegetable nutrition too. But they were busy hunting a lot. They were raiding. They were always on the move. So it was to their mutual benefit. The Comancheros, the trading individuals from Nuevo Mexico, would travel to the plains and barter the products from here. Very popular amongst the Plains Indians was the bread that was made here. Wheat bread, wheat tortillas. They were special hard loaves of bread. They would bake them so that they would turn very hard and dry so they wouldn't mold on the way out there. It took several weeks to travel by ox carts to go all the way out to the plains in what is now North Texas, Western Oklahoma, Southern Kansas, and beyond. Some of these guys went as far north as the Missouri River on trading expeditions. I was told this by an individual, a friend of mine from Taos Pueblo, that his great-grandfather had gone with a Spanish cibolero hunter trader as far north as the Missouri River looking for people in the plains to trade with. So initially, the word Comanchero meant only someone who deals and trades with Comanches, including all their other allies. Kiowas, Lipanes sometimes, Lipan Apaches, southern Texas, northern Mexico. Different. There was other agricultural peoples in Texas, native agricultural people, who also would get in on these trade events. And then, of course, they would come to the trade fairs and bring bear skins, bison robes, tanned bison robes, the leather from the bison, and some of the products that were grown in those parts that came here. I recently, last September, I attended a food and seed sovereignty conference at Tezuque Pueblo, and one of the individuals there, we got to have a good discussion. I interviewed him, and he told me, you know, the wild plums that grow around here are not native to New Mexico. I said, well, how did he? He said, you should know this. He said, Comanches brought them. That was one of the trade items they brought from the plains, from the river valleys. And the wild plums became established here by the trade with the Comanches. Now, this was according to Luis Jena, one of the agricultural experts at Tezuque Pueblo. And some other, you know, the sporadic raiding, you know, between the nomadic peoples. Also at these trade fairs, the captives were ransomed. Los cautivos del rescate, they would have el rescate. And there's a place in West Texas, it's near Midland, Odessa, Lubbock, closer to Lubbock, I believe, it's called, they call it now Ransom Canyon. It's kind of like a recreational area, el Cañón del Rescate. This was an area where the Comancheros would go and meet with tribal people to do the ransom, to trade. Literally, they were trading for captives of other peoples, of other, you know, tribal peoples, children, sometimes women. And they would bring them, and they became the criados in this, among the households of the Spanish families. They were Indians, but they were raised as Hispanics. The same thing was happening with Hispanic cautivos being raised as Plains Indians, Apaches, Utahs, and other kinds of tribal people. But the trade between Nuevo Mexico and the Comanche Nation was so important that both sides wanted to keep that peace. They wanted to keep this arrangement they had. They didn't want to be killing each other off anymore. And besides that, when you adopt somebody from someone else's culture, what's one of the things that they ask you to do? You become relatives, because they might grow up and marry one of your relatives, one of your cousins, and then you don't want to kill your relatives. One of the most famous New Mexican adventurer, soldier, patriot, Manuel Antonio Chavez, was from the families around Tomé, whose aunt had been taken captive by Comanches. Years later, on the plains, he encountered a group of Comanches who had a running battle with a larger number of Navajos, and knew when he found one of the leaders of the Comanche leaders had been killed, realized they had known this was his cousin, this was the son of his aunt, this was a grandson of the aunt probably, and they knew, these people knew here, and the Comanches would tell the young men that wanted to raid that had the Spanish heritage in them, the blood from a captive mother or, you know, child that had grown up that was adopted, it became a part of the tribe. He said, you can't raid in that area. If you're going to raid in that area, you're going to be fighting your relatives. This was unofficial. You might not find it in any documentation, but this was known amongst them. And I was told some of this by my father, my uncles, particularly the Solanos, who had at one time were part of the Rancho Zetaos community, where there's a lot of heritage influence from Plains culture, Comanches. The tradition is still carried on because the cautivos that these people adopted there, those families, had the songs and dances, and they kept them alive. And it became a part of this local heritage here that is honored on New Year's Day. And by invitation, you know, there's a lot of people, they tell people specifically to be, we are not pretending to be Indians, but we are honoring a tradition that our ancestors learned from the interaction of the captives that were adopted into these communities. So in a sense, you know, we're all mestizos. I like to say we're Spanish colonial mestizos. We're a mixture of the cultures that were involved in this area. There's a lot of French names here also that are considered Spanish. I don't, you know, you just look around, you know, Ledoux, Lefebvre, Janté, Lacombe, La Forêt. Well, the trappers came here, and a lot of them figured, let's marry somebody here, and we don't have to pay taxes because we can become citizens. Now, where have you heard this before? It's still going on, people. It's still going on. Nothing's changed in the world. The true Comancheros, the present-day Comancheros, you could say, were and are business people who would rather look the other way, pay immigrants under the table, no taxes, no social security, things they don't have to pay, and you get a labor force willing to come and do work that maybe someone else can do, or maybe they don't have enough. It's been going on for a long time. The names change, the situation change, but humanity doesn't change. People are the same, and with the advent of the newcomer people coming from the East, first into Texas, there was trading posts set up. And some of these individuals are what, and there were Hispanic and Anglo people involved in this trading. They would set these trading posts. The most famous of them were perhaps the Bent brothers in southern Colorado, who had the famous trading post, Bent's Fort, adobe fort, built by New Mexican people. They, you know, who else was going to know how to make the adobes and do the work? Who were very, you know, often there. They were always there, involved in the trading with the Plains peoples. Okay, certain individuals wanted to get in on this commerce of horses and mules because they were trading horses east and west. The horses and mules going west were going over this old Spanish trail to Los Angeles, to California. The Santa Fe Trail was another avenue that was opened in 1821 when Mexico gained independence, and the restrictions of the Spanish crown against no trade with other nations unless it's regulated by Spanish authorities ended. Well, guess what? The people here in Taos had been trading secretly with the French trappers for years. You know, tienditas up here, you know, they call tienditas because of the carpas, the little tipis of the Apaches and Comanches, Utah people that would meet there, and some of them lived there to trade with New Mexican people from around here, and the French trappers figured it out. If we can get in here and secretly trade with our Taos friends, we don't have to pay the import duties. We don't have to pay the taxes. So there was a lot of secret trading going on with the American trapper, the trappers, French, American, whatever, you know, they were. And then these marriages came about. They settled here. They stayed. And so you got another element added to it. But the Hollywood image of the Comanchero sometimes got distorted. Now, it's reputed that this was a doctor in Springer told me once that the original novel, The Comancheros, a Western paperback novel, had been written by a pharmacist in Tucumcari. And Tucumcari is right in the middle of the Comanche territory. What used to be Jicaria Apache, over the years, they disputed it. Comanches, Kiowas became dominant there. And this, apparently this man had heard of these stories and legends stuff. So he wrote this novel that Hollywood people later took and created this image of Comancheros as bandits, thieves, you know, criminals. And if you see these movies, especially like one of the most recent, The Outlaw Josie Wells, they're both Hispanic and Anglo people that are depicted as criminals. They were bending the law sometimes. Let me give you an example of how some of these people did what they did to get in on this horse and mule commerce, because the tribal people, the Comanches, Kiowas, were raiding. They were taking them from Mexico, northern central Mexico, brokering them through New Mexican Comanchero traders and American trade people.
You are listening to Jerry Padilla speaking April 25th for the Old Spanish Trail Association.
Here's an excerpt from Comanche Empire, one of the most excellent recent books that come out, by Pekka Heimolainen. It's one of the better in-depth scholarly studies of the phenomena, why Comanche Nation became so powerful in the southern plains in the southwest. Well, here's just an example. Comanche raiding thus generated a massive northward flow of property from Mexico into Comancheria and its trade channels, a development promoted by many interest groups in North America. The Bent brothers encouraged Comanches to raid Mexican settlements, as did Holland Coffee. Holland Coffee had set up a trading post in North Texas. He would tell them, "Go to the interior, kill the Mexicans, and bring me their horses and mules." By the late 1830s, it had become a common belief that enterprising American capitalists had established trading posts on the Comanche-Texas border in order to tap the immense booty that the Comanches, the most wealthy as well as most powerful, and then they're quoting about savage, you know, the nations in North America, were hauling from northern Mexico. Texas officials provided Comanche war parties free access through their state, hoping to direct the raids to Mexico, and even supplied southbound war bands with beef and other provisions. By the mid-1840s, the arrangement had solidified to the point that Chief Payayuco could ask Texas Rangers to go with his band to war against the Mexicans. New Mexico officials routinely turned a blind eye to the fact that their subjects traded in horses and mules taken from other Mexican provinces, and some New Mexicans were even rumored to be joining Comanche war parties south of the Rio Grande. From the vantage point of Chihuahua, Coahuila, Nuevo León, and Tamaulipas, it easily seemed that a depraved North American coalition of Indians, Americans, and New Mexicans had emerged to exploit and enfeeble northern Mexico. So it wasn't all about just about there was money in horses and mules in the 1830s. So all the people involved, they all got involved in it. They were all Comancheros. Technically, they were all Comancheros. So the commerce of this led to the constant raiding of northern Mexico. It had another effect. Now in 1836, the Texas colonists, who had initially petitioned under Stephen Austin to become Mexican citizens for their land grants, to establish communities in San Antonio de Bejar and Goliad and other places, revolted, as did lots of other Mexican provinces in those years. There was revolts in Zacatecas. The next year, there was a revolt in Nuevo Mexico. But remember, who was the president at the time? Think of modern times too. Had an individual down there by the name of Antonio Lopez de Santa Anna, who had come back and forth. When things were bad, he'd emerge and he says, "I'll save the nation." Well, he would organize military campaigns and stuff, and impose taxes and impose authority and so on. And he'd become very unpopular, and they'd kick him out. But when they were under attack, well, the constant raiding by Comanches in the northern Mexico depleted them of a lot of resources. They had lost their best horses and mules, and their men defending the territory, defending their homes and villages, ranches, were being killed. So as a consequence, when the revolt from Texas started in 1836, and they successfully broke away from Mexico because Santa Anna was ambushed at San Jacinto, then a few years later, they petitioned to become part of the United States. And the acquisition of Texas into American territory and the Texas independence movement resulted in a war between Mexico and the United States. Now, one of the reasons that the American forces that invaded in that war so little resistance in northern Mexico was because the Comanches and Apaches had already devastated the area. It was like wide open. The main military force, the defense, was concentrated on the capital at Mexico City, the south part. But the effect of the people, taking advantage of maybe their neighbors to the south who didn't have the same ability, they had not established the same relationships with the Plains Indians and nomadic Indians as the New Mexicans and that. And it was for survival. They wanted to survive. Both groups knew they could kill each other off, so they cooperated through the trading. And then when the first French trappers and then later American merchants, everybody got in on it. It was just the way. It was the times. So taking these trade goods, let me talk a little bit about the things that were so popular in the plains that they Piñon was one of the trade goods that the Comancheros routinely took to the tribes, to Texas, and over the parts of the plains. Piñon, chile. I was told by one of my great uncles and an elderly man in Springer who, Ben Mestas, who was also, his grandmother was from Southern Ute Nation, said, that they valued the New Mexico chile so much that Comanche people would trade a young mare with a foal for one good ristra of New Mexico chile. Now, what a deal. But you know that New Mexico chile, there was no mild in those days. It was all hot. It was all picante, and a little bit could go a long way. You make a big pot of bison stew and drop in half a pot or a pot, and you have a pretty good chile meal. It was so popular, that was one of, but it won't grow in there. It will grow, but if you're always on the move, how are you going to water it? How are you going to take care? Calabazas, the pumpkins, the calabazas, that what we call calabaza mexicana, the native pumpkins. That was one of the most popular trade goods going to the plains from New Mexico with the Comancheros. Arrowheads made out of metal. There was armeros here, people that had access to to files, and they would make arrowheads out of metal. Well, everybody also, the tribal people and the New Mexicans and the Pueblo people, they knew how to chip flint and other rocks, obsidian and slate, some basalt, some, you know, different kinds of, and to make them. But the thing with them, once they're used, once if they hit bone, they break, or if you miss the target, hits a rock or something, it's broken. But these little metal arrowheads that the New Mexicans made, that was a very popular trade item. All kinds of utensils that were made out of metal, ladles, cooking pots, and things that were coming up the trail from Mexico over the Camino Real, Chihuahua Trail, Camino Real. There was trade goods coming up from there. Don't think they weren't bringing modern European stuff up here. There's evidence that there was even fancy dishes, fancy clothes coming here for the people that could afford it, to the ricos. So the utensils, you know, brought up from Mexico, that and stuff coming down the Santa Fe Trail with Santa Fe, Taos, Pecos. This is where they would all get. This became the distribution point. So the Comancheros would go out and trade these goods: the piñon, the chile, the calabazas, cautivos sometimes taken from rival nations, Apaches, Navajos, Utahs, different, you know, Paiutes as far west as Arizona. That, you know, they'd have a rescate, and they became. They weren't necessarily slaves, depending on who became their, you know, who adopted them, but they did a lot of the work. The women in the head women in the families, who had more authority than might be admitted, they had a lot of work. There's a lot of work to tan hides by hand, preparing things to make clothes. There was an awful lot of work involved, and the cautivos were part of that. That was the labor force for amongst the Comanche Empire, Comanche Nation. Their labor force was, and if you were from another tribal group and you weren't doing too good and you weren't that good of a hunter or provider, you could go work amongst the Comanches, tanning hides and doing skills that you knew how to do, taking care of horses and mules. They had these immense herds. Even though they were trading a lot of them, they wouldn't stop raiding for them. It was a rite of passage for a young man to go on a raid and go steal a horse from the enemy. It was more honorable to take someone's prized possession. Now, this is what happened. You know, this tradition was going on up into the 1870s, till the very last. There was an incident when Colonel Mackenzie was trying to militarily force Comanches to go on the reservations, and he was leading these expeditions, and one of the things he did, he ordered, when he had rousted a camp, he caught a camp in Palo Duro Canyon by surprise. The men were off somewhere and captured a lot of horses, and he ordered them slaughtered. He said, this is their mobility. If we can't catch up to them with our army horses, and so they killed a lot of horses. Well, there was an individual, a young individual, a product of a cautivo family. His mother had been taken captive in the 1830s in Parker's Fort, Texas. And when she became of age, she had been traced. She was taken captive by an Eastern tribe from, and they weren't Comanches, but they traded her to Petenacona's family, to her. And when she became of age, he married her. They had a son who was named, his name means fragrant. He was very, very respected young raider, man. He was going to get even with Colonel Mackenzie. The best way he knew. So he came into Mackenzie's military camp one night on this campaign when they were being chased, and literally just went in, snuck in at the camp. Soldiers through the guards, the pickets, I don't know what, maybe they fell asleep, maybe they were tired. He got in, took Mackenzie's personal mount, walked out, got away with it, and stole it. You know, to add insult to injury, you know, there was no noise, no sound, nothing. But the next morning, you know, the colonel's getting, orderly, get my horse ready. He said, well, sir, you have no horse. Well, where the hell is it? Well, we don't know. Somebody took it. And thieving Comanche stole your horse. It had to be them. So this was one of the reasons that the younger men would go out to raid and steal horses and cattle stuff, because it was a rite of passage to prove that they were warriors, that they were able to provide for the families. If you wanted to, as in that culture, and this was a plains characteristic, this was a custom. When you became of age to marry and you wanted to, you had your eye on someone, and this is also something Hispanic people would do. You talk to a male relative, one of your uncles or one of your older male cousins, and he said, I like that one. Would you do me the favor, you know, go and ask. Pídele la mano, ask for her, because this was the custom. I mean, they could ask each other, and they were a lot of times they were already secretly meeting with each other and talking, exchanging pleasantry, and they had a plan. And well, the plains peoples would do this. They would a male relative would intercede, but they had to take a gift. And often the best gift was a horse or a few horses that the young man had taken on a raid where he had gone to Mexico or Texas or maybe southern New Mexico, Kansas somewhere, and brought these horses. And this was proof that he could provide for a family because he was a good hunter and a good raider. And you could bring horses to trade to the Mexico people or to the Texans. So this kept perpetuating. It was a custom. It was a social tribe. It was part of growing up, part of being in that culture, to raid and take, you know, and it had been done for centuries. It was just one of the things. If you know, they had done this with each other, and this is why certain groups moved from one area to another, and because another more powerful group would encroach, where they'd move out as the next generation was growing up. They needed lands to hunt on, and they would conflict. So instead of killing each other off all the time, someone would move on, and Shoshone people gave rise to peoples who moved further south because they were under pressure from more powerful, numerous groups in the north, Canada and northern United States now. So the source, the Shoshone nation, the Shoshonean people, were the source for Comanches, Utes, Paiutes, Bannocks, and they're also first cousins to the Aztecas and Huicholes. Dr. Enrique La Madrid has done a lot of research about the phenomenon of the cautivos and the influence of the Plains Comanches on New Mexico and northern Mexico. There are these ceremonies and celebrations of the songs and dances of things that were learned from these interaction with these people are still performed not only here, but in Bernalillo around Christmas, at Tomé during Easter, in Tula Rosa, and El Paso Juarez, but down there they call it La Devoción de los Apaches, but they're wearing Plains regalia. They're honoring, it's Apache's heritage, honoring Our Lady of Guadalupe, and call it La Devoción de los Apaches, but they're wearing Plains style regalia when they do this. And this influence is all along the Rio Grande corridor, eastern New Mexico, the village. There's all the people, if you talk to the old timers, and please, if you got an interest in true history, talk to the elders. They don't got much time left, some of them. But they haven't all been interviewed. Loren Brown in the 1930s interviewed a lot of people, and this is where some of this information comes from. Talk to the old timers. They'll tell you things that you're not going to find in books. It's never been recorded. So take a little tape recorder too. They love being paid attention to. They love to share their knowledge. So pay attention to the viejitos and the elders, and you'll learn a lot from them. My great-grandfather Solano, he would entertain us. He'd keep us all entertained, because in Springer, when we were growing up, when we were young kids, young teenagers, there wasn't all the TV reception. There wasn't any cable. There was no satellite. We could get KOMA at night after it got dark. from Oklahoma City, but a lot of time you couldn't pick up, you couldn't even get the TV. You could move the antenna around, and you know, so Papito, Grandpa Cipriano, would keep us all entertained, and he'd tell us about his times and his lives, and he had experienced these times. We don't know how old he was. When he died, they estimated that he was 90-some years old. He died in 1967. And my father said, ever since I was a little boy, you'd ask Papito, that's what we called him, you know, ask him how old he was. He was 88. He said, when I was a little boy in the 1940s, 1930s, Papito, how old are you? 88. The only numbers he knew, high numbers he could say in English. I'm 88. And he was always 88 up until the, you know. And we don't know how old he was, but he lived through a lot of these things. He knew about it firsthand as a young child, as a young man. So I've tried to give you just a little idea of this phenomenon that came about, why Comanchero came about, what it really meant, and how all the cultures that were involved in the Southwest got involved in this trade that ultimately had trade goods going in the other direction, along the old Spanish trail. Another example that you'll find some really good information here. This book initially, when I first found it, was called just A History of New Mexican Plains Indian Relations. Now it's been redone, and it's got a sexier cover, but it's got that bad word there. It's got the Comanchero Frontier, A History of New Mexican Plains Indian Relations. This is one of the most excellent books ever written about this relationship between Hispanic and Pueblo New Mexicans and the Plains Indians and the idea of trade and interaction. And it's not all peaceful. There were some interesting accounts here. I'm going to go into another. You know, there was a Tauceno named by the name of Edwin Bergwin, who at different times or the other, he was a good friend of Kit Carson and had also served in New Mexico Volunteers in the Civil War. When Captain Santiago Valdez, who was a commander of Company H of the 1st New Mexico Volunteers, that was Carson's regiment, he had to resign his commission because of his health got so bad in late 1861. Well, Edward Bergman was a Taos merchant, and he took over as the captain, and he continued in the New Mexico Volunteers and was assigned to posts along the eastern frontier, Fort Bascom, over close to Tucumcari Logan area. And he got involved in the Comanchero trade. He and other New Mexican officials would, you know, the permits that the government required that they get a permit to go trade with the Indians, they would give them goods and say, when you go trade out there, bring me back a good horse or bring me back some cows. I want to start a herd. And a lot of the officials in the government were condoning the trading and they're involved in it. So there was an incident that happened in about 1863. There was the superintendent of Indian Affairs assigned to New Mexico at the time was named Michael Steck. And he was very favorable to the trade because the leading Hispanic citizens of New Mexico explained to him, we value the peace with the Comanches. We haven't had war with them in more than 80 years. We keep that peace by trading with them. So he agreed. They didn't want to have any more raiding. They had enough problems in the southern part of the state where the Apaches were still fighting very hard. Victorio and Geronimo, Cochise, they were going to give up without a fight, and they were still resisting. And this man understood this, so he would allow the Comanchero Cibuleros the permits to go trade. And in your mixed group of people, there was an incident that happened once where it was late 1863, a wagon train was coming through the lower Cimarron area. It was that Oklahoma panhandle coming into the northeast New Mexico corner where Oklahoma, New Mexico, Colorado, Texas, all that area kind of come together. And the Comanches raided it. Some warriors, they raided this Teamster wagon. They were Teamsters. They were taking some kind of goods. And they killed five American traders. They were involved in the commerce. There was three Mexican Teamsters in the group. They referred to New Mexicans in those days as Mexicans. The Comanches recognized them as being New Mexicans, and they said, get out of here. We're not going to kill you. We have made a promise not to fight your people. And They gave him a wagon and said, get out of here. Get on your way. Be lucky you're alive. Well, when the news got back to General Carleton, who was in charge of the military department in New Mexico at the time, right after the Union forces had defeated the Confederate invaders at Glorieta Pass, had had the battles here in Valverde and around Albuquerque, the campaigns, skirmishes, and the Glorieta Pass battle, also where the Colorado Volunteers had come in to help save New Mexico Territory for the Union. Well, he said, these people are showing preference to other citizens against the American citizens, because by then we were all American citizens, our ancestors at those times. And he wanted to have a campaign, a military campaign, to teach the Comanches a lesson. You don't bother our people on the Santa Fe Trail or in whatever branch we're there. And the politicians, as they came, they would come to him, don't do this. You're going to start a war, and it's going to hurt a lot of people. The leadership among the Comanche Nation, particularly individual Parawasamen, known better, in English, Ten Bear, also came to the fort, to the New Mexico area, and he said, don't start a war with our people because nobody's going to win. It's going to be a tragedy. It'll be a disaster. And General Carleton was one of these individuals who, nobody's going to tell him how to do things, so he insisted. And it went back and forth, negotiating the leadership from the Comanche Nation to talking to the leadership in New Mexico. Don't have this fight. Don't do this. We've had peace for so many years because we trade. Let us keep trading. We'll try to keep the young men under control. Well, it didn't work. Carleton insisted, so he picked the command and expedition of New Mexico Volunteer Cavalry, a few companies. He picked Colonel Christopher Kit Carson, who had just recently brought Navajo resistors to Fort Sumner, to the Bosque Redondo. And Carson, although he got along well with Native Americans and he had a lot of respect for them, he had no problem fighting anybody if he was given orders, and he was in the military and he was given orders, he'd carry out his orders. There's other individuals in our times that have done the same thing. Okay, he led this expedition and took his Ute and Jicarilla allies, auxiliary soldiers, traditional rivals of Comanches. And it was in November of 1864, they went to the old adobe walls in North Texas, which had been one of the Bent brothers' original trading posts. Okay, Carson led this New Mexican force out of here. There was supposed to be another group coming out of Kansas to try to catch them in between along the Canadian River in North Texas. It was a Comanche stronghold still. The military authority in Kansas couldn't send anybody because at the time the war was still going on in the east. All right, the force was going onto the plains. Ahead of them went to some of their New Mexican friends, and they told them, the soldiers are coming, We tried to talk them out, but this is going to happen. Get ready. And when Carson's group at one point, they came upon a Kiowa camp. He set fire to it. They destroyed all the women, children, the old people got away. He allowed them time to get out. Then he destroyed all their supplies. He burnt everything. Well, before the smoke had settled, here comes 1,000 Comanche warriors from downstream who had already been warned by New Mexican allies. We'll tell it like it is. Their Hispano-New Mexican allies had warned them that this was happening. So when they saw the smoke and they said, something's wrong with our Kiowa allies, and they went to check it out, they surrounded them. They had a good long battle. The only thing that saved them was that they had amongst some of their volunteers that had come from California that had joined the New Mexican volunteers, some men that could operate mountain howitzer. And they had one of these little mountain howitzers, these little cannons. You could take them apart and load them on mules and go anywhere with them and then set them up. So they held off this surround of Comanche Kiowa warriors with this little cannon. And when they couldn't get close enough, so then the Indians set fire to the grass. And Carson was not stupid. He knew he was outnumbered. He knew that they weren't going to be able to win this if they insisted. So they retreated. They came back. He reported, I destroyed a camp. They won't be bothering us this season. But you know, I got to blame that we didn't have a success because some individuals who I don't think that's their real names, Jesus Amaya and Jose Castillo, he said they had gone ahead and warned them, so there was no surprise attack. You know, they hadn't been able to succeed. Well, what happened after that attack, several young Comanches decided, well, if they were our allies, now they're raiding us, let's raid them back. And they carried out a series of raids throughout eastern New Mexico on newly established ranches and settlements. They got even, and then they stopped. There's another individual here in town who told me an interesting story about his grandfather, who was from Puerto de Luna. And in Puerto de Luna, they would grow, and some of them probably still do, something that is known here as maíz concha. And it's a kind of corn that's grown specifically to make chicos. This was another popular item amongst the Comanche people. And when they would come to Puerto de Luna, sometimes they would always help themselves to some of this corn, or they'd be invited. You know, they always made sure there was enough people left there to keep growing this maíz concha, because it was very popular, and it was also one of the trade items. So the agricultural products from the Rio Grande Valley and utensils, things they could get in exchange for the horses and mules, cautivos. As the years went on into the 1860s and 70s, the trade in the cautivos had stopped because the laws had been passed against slavery and peonage. They fought a war over it, and Mr. Lincoln had proclaimed, no more of this, no more. And this not just black, but anyone. There was not to be any. And being a peon was just like being a slave. You're too poor. You worked for the patron all your life, your children, grandchildren. Sometimes it was a generational thing because they would loan you money or they would bail you out, and then in return you work for them. And that's how Kit Carson ended up coming out here, because he was an indentured servant. He was a peon. When his father died and the family went broke, they hired him out to a saddle maker. And his life was so miserable as a young man that some of the New Mexican traders going up the Santa Fe Trail, Comancheros, felt sorry for him. They helped him escape. And he made his way west, and he joined the trappers and the mountain men. And so there's another little nugget for you about Comancheros, how they influenced bringing one of the best known and respected Taos heroes here. And this was told to me by Mr. Maestas at Springer many years ago. And he said, all I can remember about was that it was somebody named Gonzalez that was traveling that Santa Fe Trail a lot to Missouri. He felt sorry for him because they were treating him like a slave, so he helped him escape. He made his way out here. So I can't remember anymore about who their name was, but that's how he came to be here. So I think I'm about out of time. Buena aventura, buenas gracias.
You have been listening to Jerry Padilla speaking April 25th for the Old Spanish Trail Association. To hear a longer version of this talk and more than 2,100 other segments online, go to culturalenergy.org. This is Robin Collier, and thanks for listening.